by an affair or a betrayal, or who has committed an affair or a betrayal against their spouse. Infidelity is rampant in our culture. We think that somewhere between 50 and 60% of all marriages in America before the end of that marriage will experience some form of infidelity. There are more than one forms of infidelity, as you may imagine. So, before we start, I'd like you to turn to the person on the right. Everyone look to the right, okay. Now look to the left. Okay. Now you didn't make eye contact, right? No. Now this time, I'm not going to tell you which way to go, but try to make eye contact with one of the people next to you without saying anything. Take a moment. Make some eye contact. All right. Now have a chance to shake hands with the person on the right and on the left. Shake hands. Take your time. Shake hands. Yeah. Come on and sit down. Shake hands. Look them in the eye. Okay. So, barring all of that, that is all appropriate contact with members of the opposite sex. Okay. The thing that happens, the reason to infidelity happens is not because of lack of love, not because the spouses have taken each other for granted necessarily, not because one spouse or another has let themselves go emotionally, physically, spiritually. It's because there was a transgression of inappropriate contact with someone of the opposite sex. How many people, you don't raise your hand, but many, many people believe that infidelity happens because there is a lack of love or a lack of a strong relationship, or as they said kind of in the 50s, well, he or she is not getting what they need at home, and so that's why they went outside the marriage. That is not the reason for infidelity. And the way we know this is there have been some longitudinal studies done by Gary Chapman's Foundation is one of the ones that I'm familiar with, where he has done studies about why people have affairs. And when they got enough respondents away from their spouses, understanding if respondents made their responses in the presence of their spouse, it was different. But when they responded out of the presence of their spouse, they admitted that it wasn't their spouse's fault. It was because they had an inappropriate attachment to someone in their lives that was not their spouse. So, let's do a couple of things. When we think about affair repair, if you take nothing away from this today, I'd like you to remember that hope restored is your job. As a counselor, as a minister, as a friend, as a nurse, as anyone who interacts, hope restored is your job. Because if infidelity is to be conquered, it means we can offer to the couple, if they are so inclined, to heal from that experience. At the risk of being a little bit crude, I'm going to give you a little mnemonic, I think it's called, for how to think about affairs and divorce. Marriages mostly end not with a bang, but with a whimper. So think about that. It was thought by most people logically that the greatest reason for marriages, and if you ask lawyers this, they will tell you this anecdotally, that affairs are the major reason for divorce in America, and it turns out that is just plain not true. Affairs do not necessarily cause divorce. Again, most marriages end with a whimper, not a bang. And that whimper, I believe, is a collective sigh of, I can't trust, and I don't feel the love. The love connection between spouses is not getting... I'm so sorry, someone's beeping at me. Just stop that. I have this on to keep track of time, so we'll do that. So anyway, as we think about that...
Can I ask you to put the mic a little closer to you?
I would love that. Because I like nothing better than being heard, right? Especially by my spouse. Is that better? All right. I'll be happy to speak up, too. All right. So if you look at your outline, infidelity is a result of dangerously friendly associations. It is not a result of the spouse being unwilling to give themselves sexually or to give themselves emotionally or to take care of the other spouse or ignoring the spouse. When I counsel couples who are trying to repair their marriage after an affair, often, no, I'm going to say always, the offending party is usually ready to say, yes, I did something wrong. I'm sorry. They walk in that way. If their intention is to repair their marriage, and you may see this in your practice or in your church, the offending parties walk in with their spouse and say, okay, yes, I have had an affair and I am sorry. Inevitably, as the conversation goes along, the offending party finds themselves in a position to answer this question. Why did you do this? The party that has been offended, I hate to say words like victim and transgressor, I'm just going to say the offending party and the offended. The offended party will say, why? And the offending party looks down and says, I don't know, it's hard for me to explain it to you. They'll start saying lots of things about, well, I did this and I did that, but, you know, it just seems like you turned away from me. You will hear that. So the offended party hears that as what? What do you think? How do you think they hear that? It's my fault. Oh, I had a part in this. Gosh, that's what people say. If the person isn't getting what they need at home, they're going to go out and have an affair. And guess what? That's not true. That's the first myth I would like you to bust today when you think about affairs. It is not okay to blame the victim. Remember, those of you who are old enough to remember the 70s, there were books like that all over the place, blaming the victim. Well, they were right. It's not okay to blame the victim of an affair. It is not because they didn't cook the right dinners. It is not because they didn't wear the right clothes. It is not because they didn't have enough sex. It's because the other person entered into an association. I don't think we have any rabbis here, but that was just not kosher. It just isn't. It's just not kosher to get that intimate with someone else emotionally. All right. There are more than one kinds of affairs. I guess you guys have heard that, right? Give me an example. Give me an example of one kind of an affair. Somebody, please. More than one kind of affairs. What's an emotional affair? Help me out. Oh, exactly. Ding, 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 ding. That's right on the quiz. So when you sign the quiz, you'll be doing really well. It's a dangerously friendly association. I'll give you an example. Well, I'll explain that in a second. But what's another kind of an affair that exists? Think modern day technology. Social media. And what happens on those social media affairs? It's kind of a continuum of things that happen. What are they? Ooh, that's a big one. The path not taken. The one that got away. Oh, it's harmless if I just talk to them on Facebook, find out how their life is going, and then we talk on Facebook, and then we get our private emails, and then we meet for lunch, and we rekindle an old flame. And somehow that chemistry of looking into their eyes calls up a wellspring from my soul, and I feel that I am once again heard, that I have come again home to someone else. And my wife and I'll pretend I'm a guy. My wife and I don't really talk about emotional things in our lives. We don't talk about what's bothering us. We just get through the day. And bing, 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 just like that little bing from my phone, something happens inside. And we gain an inappropriate connection. So this is about connection. Give me one more example of an affair that I think is really critical for us to consider today. And not all scholars are in agreement on this one, but I'm going to bring it out there. What is another type of affair, aside from the purely sexual one, the emotional affair, the cyber affair? One more. Help me out.
Using pornography.
Okay. There's two there. Okay. So go ahead.
Using pornography. A lot of spouses see that as adultery or close to it.
Yes. And I want you to consider your own conscience on that one. What do you think about that? What would you say to someone who said, well, you know, I use porn and I use it inappropriately, and is that an affair? My wife says it is, or my husband says it is. There are women now who use cyber porn. Don't answer. Just think about it. Do I consider that an affair? Well, you decide. I'm going to read you a little definition. This is all in your package. You don't have to look at it. We'll make sure you have it. Emotional affairs are characterized by secrecy, emotional intimacy, and sexual chemistry. Emotional affairs can be more threatening than brief sexual flings. Now, imagine if it's cyber porn. How am I having an emotional affair? Well, here's why, and I want you to put yourself just in the mindset of sexual connection, okay? That person that I'm looking at on the screen, who is displaying themselves to me in a sexual way, looks welcoming, has a look on their face as if they like me. They appear to be all accepting and consuming. They appear to think I am great. The sexual encounter, albeit is not of the flesh, it exists sort of in this one square foot of real estate right up here. Okay, that cyber sexual encounter happens up here. The way it permeates the psyche of the person means I can connect with these people in a way that's perfect. There's no messiness. There's no concern for whether or not I'm being accepted or loved, or if I didn't put the garbage out earlier and I'm a scum because I didn't do that or because I forgot their birthday. This person thinks I rock. That is the attraction, and that is one of the main reasons that cyber porn, or any kind of porn, but particularly cyber porn, because usually those are moving pictures. I don't know if you knew that, but they're moving pictures. And so these people look like someone in my life, looks like they accept me on 100%, so why wouldn't I get a much more satisfying sexual experience from them? And then the really sad thing happens is this person then loses the ability to respond sexually when an actual human is in the room. So I want you to consider all these forms of affairs. I had a client for many years who came because their spouse, it was the male, insisted that his wife was having an affair, and she said, but we've never touched each other. We are friends in the church. We have dinner together with our spouses. We've never touched each other. She said, but I've seen your texts, and they're very intimate texts. They're very emotionally intimate texts. This is an affair. So it took about 6 months to convince this spouse that she was, in fact, committing adultery. Then the process began. If someone would like to disclose, and if you don't feel comfortable, don't do it, but if you do, it's okay. Disclose something that you've experienced in your work, an example of a case. Say you're a pastor and a couple has come to you, and it's, you know, just give us an example of what these people look like when they come to you with this subject in mind, if anybody would like to disclose that, to dispel a couple of myths. Perhaps you're a pastor and a couple comes and says, you know, this has happened to us. We want to stay married. This has happened to us. We don't know if we should stay married. Or you're a counselor and you have a question. All right. You'll get a chance to do it. Go ahead.
The offended person is usually experiencing a lot of trauma.
Okay.
Sometimes they just came out of nowhere. They had no clue.
Okay. And what's the hardest part for you? Are you a pastor?
Counselor.
Counselor, okay. What would you say is the hardest part for you?
Well, I guess to get the offended spouse to understand it was not there.
Okay. I'm glad you pointed that out. There is so much guilt and shame on both sides. You'd be surprised. Certainly it makes sense that if the offending party is willing to admit the error of their ways, they feel shame. You'd be surprised how much shame exists for the offended party.
Sex, esteemed that way as a
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So I'm going to give you a term that a couple of people in the room who are my colleagues will know. It's the difference between earned and unearned guilt. Earned guilt comes from God. It's our conscience. It's right there in the Ten Commandments, we know what we should feel guilty about. It's pretty clear. God said, don't do this. Feel guilty if you do it. And that guilt can be very instrumental in helping us change. The unearned guilt is the type of guilt that should scare us and we should pay attention to, because most people can handle their earned guilt. Most of us can access the God-given quality of, this is bad, I get this. The unearned guilt, which is usually what I might call vicarious guilt, guilt that comes from a vicarious association with another, is the kind we have to be careful with, and that is what you just described. And if we can put it in those terms, helping the parishioner discern between earned and unearned guilt is probably your first goal. So think about it. You've got a husband and a wife. Let's pick. Who's the offending party, husband or wife? We're doing an example. All right, we'll make it a husband. We'll be kind of tough on the guys. Okay, so the offending party is the husband. The offended party is the wife. First thing to establish, earned and unearned guilt. Now, your job is not to be like Reverend Bradford with sinners at the hands of an angry God and to in any way chastise the offender. He's already, or in this case he's been through enough. He's already run the gauntlet of shame. Identification is great. Shaming is bad. Then what's the next thing in here? If you're following along, this Not Just Friends, an excellent book about infidelity by Shirley Glass, which I recommend to everyone. It's extraordinarily well done. It's applicable to both the professional, the pastor, and the person involved in the affair. On the second page, recognize and state what ought to have happened. You need to state specifically that you have done harm to your partner. This is for the offender. Engaging in sexual relationships or emotional affairs cross the bounds of expected behavior of a loyal spouse. That's the point. There's no other point. When you got married, and someday I'm going to get caught short on this one, I always say, so was this an arranged marriage? So when they say no, I say, well, then you picked each other. Okay, so let's kind of go from there that you picked each other. Someday I'm going to get an arranged marriage and I'm going to be stuffed, I'm quite sure. But when they came, hopefully, fully aware of their own needs and desires and wants and loves to that day that they made the commitment, there was something there in the vows, and those of you who say these vows and marry people every once in a while can help me out. But it says, I wrote it down, I will leave my parents and cleave unto you. It's an opportunity to rest in my partner. I will keep myself only unto you. Well, that notion of keeping myself only unto you is a compact for loyalty and a promise to keep myself away from someone else. So when I violate that, that is the transgression part. We think it's the sex. You know, some clients, some offended parties will say, all I can do when I close my eyes is think about him having sex with her. I will say to you that that is somewhat rare. It does happen, and I'm treating a patient just like that right now. What they are thinking about is, I can't believe he turned away from me. And so we say, consider all the ways in which you have failed to meet your commitment, including deception, absences from home, impact on the family and community. If you don't make it clear how exactly you hurt your partner, then your apology will fall upon deaf ears. So that is the best advice you can ever give to the offending party. I'll read it again. It's so important. Please consider all the ways in which you have failed to meet your commitments, including deception, absences from home, and impact on our family and the community. Often churches are let down, often other organizations, places of work where many, many affairs happen. You've let that whole community down. And if you don't make it clear exactly how you hurt your partner, then your apology will fall upon deaf ears. All right, so that's sort of like infidelity 101, what to say to the offending party. Now let's pay attention to her, this woman that's been offended. We're going to have to make some introductory statements to her. And this one should be pretty easy for you. What plagues you the most? What troubles you the most at this time is a wonderful question to ask. I would not ask that to the offending party, because they're usually quite tongue-tied. The offended party, the tie has been loosed. And they will say, I want to know why, and I want to know how. If I were you, I would not address in that first session the why. That takes a long time. And if I were you, I would not say, well, don't ask why, that doesn't matter. Actually, it matters a great deal to the offended party. It really does. It may not matter to you as the clinician or as the pastor, but it will matter to the offended party. I encourage you not to unpack that in the first meeting. I encourage you to say how and allow them to unpack that. Allow the offended party to explain how. That's counterintuitive, isn't it? Gosh, do they really want to know the ins and outs of what happened? Do they really want that mental picture? Yes, they do. In order for them to close the door someday, and it won't be that first session, but someday they will be able to close the door upon their thoughts and their worries. They have to open that Pandora's box and look inside. It's not going to be fun for you, okay? It's going to be very hard for you as the person sitting in the room. While you are doing these initial questions, I recommend that you do something else, that you consider self-support at all times. And what I mean by that, any of us who have ever sat in the intensity of a room that is filled only by the three of us, the two parties who are married and myself, I don't care what size the room is, it's going to feel too small because that pain is so palpable. It really is. So support yourself. Breathe. Shift in your chair. Have some water for yourself so that you're not tempted to do this one fatal mistake. Can you imagine what your most fatal mistake might be when confronted with a couple who are for the first time expressing their concerns on this subject? Mm-hmm. What's the thing you shouldn't do?
Your own personal opinion, basically.
Opinion. Like what? An example that might be bad.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, he sucks. You better get out of here. Okay, that's a good one. What else? That's very good. Anything else? Oh, my goodness, right. And why would a very loving, caring person who's pretty bright, like yourself, want to minimize? Yeah, because I want to get away from that. Ouch. I want them to get away from the ouch. Oh, they look so uncomfortable. I like them. I've known them for 20 years. They've been in my parish forever. I just want to make them feel better. I'll just say something that'll, fix it. Don't do it. And here's how to stay away from it. Breathe deeply. Drink water and ask questions. Do not give solutions. If you learn nothing from this, I have learned it from the past. Solutions matter nothing for them. Your job, if you really get stuck and you want to take out your Bible, honest to God, this works, and pastors, you're going to get away with this a lot better than the rest of us. I offer to you one place of hope, and it's Matthew 8, 5 through 10, and you can look that up. If you want to use it, great. If you find a better one, email me, because I'm always looking for those hope-filled scriptures. Go to the place of hope. Hope is available to you. Marriages do not have to end. This is another important message to give them on this first meeting. Marriages do not have to end because of infidelity. You may feel as if you want to run right now. I encourage you to make your decision as wisely as possible and with as much time between now and when you make your decision as possible. Impulsive decision-making on this subject is almost always bad. It hurts children, it hurts us, it hurts God, it hurts everyone. So I work with that. Okay, let's move down to myths about infidelity and who is at risk. It's not about sex. If you thought it was, and you still think it is when we're done with this seminar, come up and talk to me about it. I'd like to know what you have to say. But it really, really, really is not about sex. even people who are sex addicts, and I've worked with some sex addicts, and let me say that that is an important subset to be separated out from infidelity. If the offending party is a sex addict, and that's a whole extra subject, but if the offending party is a sex addict, that is a different kind of an affair and must be treated in a different way, because that is a compulsive act. It's both impulsive and compulsive, but it is something that they cannot control and has more to do with reaching for something that quells my emotions than an intimacy problem that I have without windows and walls. We're going to talk about windows and walls in a minute. Marriage, one other thing you could write down, marriage is not the kiss of death infidelity is not the kiss of death for marriages. More marriages end because people do not get along, then they end because of infidelity. You'll have to take my word for that. If you're curious about the study, it is cited in one of the papers that I gave you. Who is at risk? So that brings us to the questionnaire. In your packet, and if you didn't get a packet, raise your hand and I'll give you a questionnaire. Okay. There are, on the left side, there is a questionnaire, and I'd like you to fill it out. Take a couple of seconds. I'm sorry, you need some? Yeah. And even if you've never had an affair, or you've never had an emotional affair, or you've never had any sort of inappropriate experience with the person of the opposite sex, that's okay. Do it anyway. Take the test. I want to put you in the mindset of how a perfectly God-fearing, loving human, how it is possible for them to have an affair. Yes, there are two. Individual vulnerability map, and there's another one that is, and it doesn't really matter, is your online, here, this is the online one.
Has your friendship become an affair?
Has your friendship become an affair? Yeah, you can do either one. There are two of them. Has your friendship become too friendly? Is your online friendship too friendly? Here you go. I'm so sorry we don't have enough packets. We were told to expect 25 people. We've got a lot more, so we're very, very thrilled to have this problem. Okay, you just fill it out. Did you get one, sir?
Yeah.
Okay, just fill it out. If it doesn't apply to you, okay, I just want you to read it. And I'll give you a little hint. It introduces the concept of windows and walls. Windows and walls. Marriages must have both. This is also super helpful in your premarital counseling. These sort of questionnaires are very helpful. Whoops. If you're done, just look up and look around. Anybody have a comment having done this? Something they didn't see before? Something they knew before? Did anything about it surprise you? There's a lot of squirming. I have a feeling. Anytime I take a boundary questionnaire, anything that has to do with boundaries with other humans, I squirm in my seat. I think to myself, oh, I've read all those boundary books by John Townsend. He's so great. And I guess my boundaries aren't as firm as I thought they were. I think we're all a little bit guilty of smushing boundaries from time to time. So I encourage you not to grab onto some unearned guilt. I encourage you to just sort of reflect a little bit about how easy this is, how easy it would be to transgress with someone else. how easy it would be to be, how shall I say, encouraged to transgress. How easy it would be to look in the eyes of that other person and see my own living soul and think, this is what I've been missing. And don't worry, I'm going to give you some anecdotes on how to avoid that. I will do that. They're actually fairly simple. All right. So while you're thinking about this quiz, I want you to keep this in mind. Infidelity is not about love or sex. It's about maintaining appropriate boundaries with others. I'll say that again. It's about maintaining appropriate boundaries with others and being open and honest in your committed relationship. So let's think about these ideas as a circle, not a straight line. People who commit adultery, think of their relationships as straight lines. I relate to you, I get something from you, or I don't. People who tend to not commit adultery have have healthy attachment notions because they think of attachment as a two-way street or a circle. I communicate with you, you communicate with me, I listen, I speak, you listen, you speak. We think about them together. We talk about it some more, we come back and do it again. If I see my relationship as a circle, my relationship with my spouse, I am more inclined to stay in the circle than go outside. If I think about my relationship as a straight line, honey, what have you done for me lately? You guys know what I mean by that. Anybody can give me an example of, oh, honey, what have you done for me lately way of relating to your spouse? She spends too much money and it makes me not want to love her. He drinks too much. I can't love that. He has a bad temper. She's too tough on the kids. If I think about a what have you done for me lately economy in my marriage, then I am likely to stray. If I am able to do this thing that I just talked about, maintain appropriate boundaries and be open and honest in a committed relationship with my spouse, if I bring all things to my spouse, if we become adept at handling conflict together, then we are less likely to go outside the marriage. And if you want to make it even simpler, and boil it down even further. If I'm having a conversation with a member of the opposite sex that I would never have with my wife, I better stop doing it. I'll say that again. If I'm having a conversation with a member of the opposite sex that I would never have with my spouse, because I said that wrong, I better stop having that conversation. Did anybody see that in the questionnaire? Did that come forward? Give me an example of what they're talking about in the questionnaire. I was hoping that would come home to you. So, one of the things I'm supposed to talk to you about here today that Carl asked me to do is to remind you that if you are a pastor and you are faced with a couple who is keenly interested in rebuilding their marriage, we encourage you to give them a couple of rules. And the last rule is go seek out a counselor. I'm just going to stick to the last one. Okay. But for you, the first two rules go like this. First of all, the affair must end today. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200 and this affair today. Do not talk to the affair partner ever again. Do not text the affair partner ever again. Do not cybermail the partner. Do not have any association. Take them out of your phone. Promise your partner that you, your spouse, that you will cut off all ties with the affair partner. I'll give you an example of a case study that I did for years. I worked with a wonderful couple where the husband worked out of the country much of the time. He was an industrialist and he ran an industrial plant in a, we'll just call it Croatia. That wasn't the country, but let's pretend it was. He developed an attachment and an attraction. There's two things there. A real attachment and attraction to his secretary because he visited this plant 1 week out of every month. It was lonely. It's a really small town. in this behind the Iron Curtain country, and they had an affair. Well, one day his wife found out, doesn't really matter how, but she found out, and they came to me, and he said, yes, I'm stopping the affair. I will definitely stop the affair. But I have to see her every day. I mean, every day for 1 week out of the month. I said, well, you're going to have to ask to be transferred. If you really want to repair your marriage, your wife is never going to be able to trust you if she knows you see this woman every single day. This is a very tough concept to sell to people who've had an affair. They say, well, I won't do it again. I can't lose my job. This is my secretary. What am I supposed to do? Get a new secretary. It's very critical that you do that. Well, it took a long time, and we eventually convinced him to do that. But no emotional change happened in their marriage until he did that. Can you guess why? Anybody? Trust. But what did this woman need? What did she need more than anything in the world on that week that he was spent away from her in this foreign country? What did she need to know? Very good. And that he couldn't see this other woman, like physically be with her. Okay, well, this was a tough sell, this guy. So finally I listened to the radio one day. I don't know if any of you listen to Word FM. I listen to it all the time. And Steve Arterburn gave this story, and I love this story, and this really helps bring this idea home. So once there was a man who had a dog. It was a great dog and had a big, long tail, and this dog followed the man everywhere he went. Have you heard this? Have you heard this? Oh, good. This is new material for you. Great. Okay. So he followed this dog, and he was cutting the grass one day, and the dog always followed him everywhere, cutting the grass. And, of course, dog ran quickly in front of the riding mower and ripped off his tail. Oh, the man took him to the vet. It was traumatic. There was blood everywhere. It was horrible. Well, the vet was able to save the dog, thankfully. Dog comes home. Dog couldn't go outside for a long time. I mean, they had to find a place for him to do his business in the house. That's how bad this was. Eventually, the dog got a little better. He went outside. Dog never went near that part of the lawn where the accident happened. Or wouldn't go near that part of the lawn where the accident happened. After a while, he did. The dog forgot. Dog had trouble going up to the man when he had his work overalls on. Does it remind him of the experience? Dog got over that. There's one thing the dog never got over until the day the dog died, was the sound of the lawnmower revving up. The dog went crazy every time he heard the sound of the lawnmower. So they had to find a way to keep the dog safe, so they found a little crate for the dog that they were able to soundproof. And then the dog didn't have a weekly trauma, re-traumatization. And that's basically what it was. I know it's a dog, but honestly, that's what was happening. So in order to keep the dog happy, they always put him away in this place where he couldn't hear the revving. Your job as the transgressor in the relationship is to make sure your spouse never hears the sound of the lawnmower revving up. You must make it super clear. You must keep them protected from any smell, any sound, any notion that you are going near the lawnmower. And the lawnmower, of course, is your affair partner. That's your job. If you do nothing else, you better do that first. Okay? And that's how we try. It's one of the ways I try to convince people, look, you've got to stop it. I've had people come into my office and try to repair their marriage, and honest to God, they still want to keep the affair going. I mean, they will look me straight in the eye and say, well, I don't see why it's that bad. I mean, we'll still be friends. We'll still take our walks. No. This is an issue of intimacy. So, it seems pretty simple, but you'll be surprised how hard it will be. Okay, so we covered what to say to the couple when they come to see you. Some things to avoid saying to the couple that is ready to embark on a marital recovery process. One of them is try to forget. Don't say it. Don't say try to forget. Because nobody should ever forget what happened. But you might say, well, crap, what am I supposed to do? The offending party will say, what am I supposed to do when my spouse constantly brings it up? A lot of spouses do. They'll keep bringing it up. Can you imagine why a spouse might keep bringing it up? And this is barring any mental illness. Just a... Anger's one? Okay, good. What else? What? What do you need reassurance for? Okay, that's one. Okay. Yes. Pain's still there. Well, how do you mean? The pain of? Okay. So very clearly the pain of the... And as long as they need to. And anyone else? Yes.
Maybe they need to hear that other person be clear upon that it's over on the other person. They need the reassurance that it's definitely over.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely sure. They need that. That's going to take some time. That could be 5 or 6 sessions, you know, just knowing that. Oh, revenge. And we're going to get to that. I'm going to hold that revenge piece over here just for a minute because we're going to get to something that can be a healthy substitute for the need for revenge. Okay, because, you know, revenge gets us nowhere. We all know that. It's a cancer we give ourselves. However, it's in there. We want to give revenge. So there is an anecdote. I'm going to hold that over here and don't let me forget. One more. Anything else?
It's a reminder that the difficulties aren't their fault.
Oh, to remind themselves. They bring it up to remind themselves. Okay. Okay. Exactly. It might have been the lawnmower started to rev up. Or they listened to Christian radio and they started talking about infidelity. Who knows? Or the priest talked about it at church this week. Whatever it is. Okay. One of the things that can help the offended party with those recurring thoughts is to encourage, and you can do this with the offending party, you can tell them that they need to appreciate the impact that their actions have made on their partner. And I don't mean that like I'm going to beat this with a dead horse so you know how bad you are in that kind of way. That's not your intent. Your intent is not to make the offending partner feel as if they are a bad person, but you're to appreciate the impact that this had. Say, it's not enough to say that you messed up. You also have to make it clear to your spouse. And this is right in there. I've supplied these words directly for you in your packet. You also have to make it clear that you can see how you have pained your partner by your actions. Sometimes the hurt goes beyond emotional duress. Affairs cause financial strain, inconvenience of time, disruption of living situations. Saying I have hurt you by what I did helps make you be and appear accountable. I know that I have hurt you. Then teach them this other thing. Don't let them put the word but after they say that. If they want to keep going and say, I have hurt you by what I did, but, in an elementary way, try to get them to start with and. If they absolutely can't shut their mouth after they finish that first phrase, because some people can't, encourage them to use the word and. And I was so taken by her and it won't ever happen again. And I let my guard down. And hopefully they'll be able to admit the place where they entered into an inappropriate emotional attachment. Which brings me to the next thing, and I promise I will get to your point because revenge is very important. Windows and walls. Healthy windows and walls. Shirley Glass talks a lot about this. John Gottman, who, anyone has ever read anything, I recommend those two, we'll call psychological gurus. They've written a lot about infidelity, and they've compiled research. John Gottman himself has done some research in the area of infidelity, and he's very reliable. They both talk about things like windows and walls. So, a window in a healthy relationship must have windows and walls. Walls are the things we keep out of our relationship, the things that are no non-starters, the things that absolutes. In every healthy household, there must be some always, some nevers, and some sometimes. And across the lifespan of our children and across the lifespan of our marriages, we do well to kind of change those always and nevers and sometimes. You can have a whole lot of sometimes, a few always, and a few nevers. And you will probably have a relatively functional family. Same thing is true with your marriage. A couple of always, a couple of nevers, and a bunch of sometimes. So as you can imagine, the windows are the sometimes, the walls are the always and the nevers. So in the structure of my marriage, think of it as a house. The walls are, doors, by the way, don't apply to this metaphor. I don't know why, but they just don't. So I'm going with Shirley's thing on this. Windows open and close. Those are people we let in and out of our marital relationships. Most generally other couples, single people who are safe, single people who we hold in common as friends. And there can be individuals that we don't hold in common as friends, maybe people at work, but we make sure that we have some walls in those relationships. And the walls sound like this. I don't tell my friends anything that I wouldn't be comfortable saying in front of my spouse. I don't tell my friends anything about my spouse that I wouldn't be comfortable saying to my spouse. And I never divulge information to my friends that I wouldn't divulge, or that I want to divulge to them instead of my spouse. If I start talking to someone about something that I talk to them instead of talking to my spouse, ding, 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 bad idea. That will encourage a certain amount of intimacy. That, the only exception to that is same-sex friends. It is really okay and usually a very good idea to have same-sex friends in your life who are just as invested, and this really matters, in your marriage as you are. So it's cool to have, you don't want to have same-sex friends who maybe are recently divorced and you tell them stuff about your marriage because they may be a little bit invested in you getting a divorce. So you want same-sex friends who are invested in you staying married. Maybe they like your spouse. Maybe they think your spouse is cool. Not in an inappropriate way. But it's okay to say, oh, if he chews that loud one more time, I'm going to knock his head off at dinner, or whatever it is. Okay? You need to be able to vent to a same-sex friend. Did I mention it was same-sex? Same-sex friend. Not friend of the other. Okay. Also, even in that situation, I should not ever talk to anybody about something that I would not talk to my spouse. If there is something I cannot tell my spouse, call a therapist and work that through. And then hopefully that therapist will encourage you to work it through with your spouse. That's how healthy relationships happen. Okay, let's get back to the revenge piece. Shirley Glass, who I love, talks about that, and it's again in this handout for yours. Make amends. It's critical for the offending party at some point in the repair relationship to make amends. And within that process, they're going to have to do a couple of things. If you've done something wrong, it's reasonable for that person to want you to make it right in some way. Because this revenge piece comes from, we will never be on equal terms. I want revenge because I want you to be at the same level that you put me in, which is a lower level than we were before. You have diminished me in some way by this offense that you've visited upon me. Okay, so never would we counsel a couple to say, okay, well, you need to even the score, go out and do the same thing, or in some way cut your spouse down to size the way they cut you down. No, Christ wouldn't have said that. Pretty sure. Wasn't there, but don't think he would. So this is what can be a nice balm for that feeling of being cut down to size, which brings around the notion of I need revenge because someone cut me down, right? This includes saying, I'm sorry and I have hurt you. Beyond that, however, you must do something to make up for your errors. I'm quoting from Shirley in this case. That's what restitution is about. It boils down to saying, I know I can never undo what I did, but here's what I plan to do going forward. First, you must offer to make change. We talked about that. Make a commitment to stay faithful in your future. In the future, agree to transparency. Those are the windows in your relationship, and work on improving the marriage. Next, you may want to offer some form of gesture that is handpicked by your spouse, such as agreeing to visit your in-laws and be nice to them. That's the really important part, be nice to them. Next weekend, or bringing home a bouquet of roses. These offers are not trying to bribe your partner away from his or her convictions. It's not like you're bribing them and hoping they'll say, oh, honey, it was okay that you did that. That's not the point. It's a gesture to say, I am willing to put my heart, my soul, and even my bank account if I need to on the line to prove to you that I am going forward going to be to cleave only unto you. The restoration of the marriage vow in a very tangible way includes making restitution. Now here's the tricky part, and this is something I think we would all do well to help our married partners, married friends do. In the area of gift giving or doing nice things for, the key is to know what the spouse wants us to do, not to do what we think the spouse needs or should have. I went to a seminar one time and there were couples in the room and the guy goes, okay, so all the men here who send their wives red roses, raise your hand. So most of them said that. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. All the men who send flowers to their wives, raise your hand. And most of the men raise their hands. And all of them who send red roses, raise your hand. And that was like 3/4. And then he said, now I'd like to ask how many women in the room like getting flowers. And a bunch of people raised their hand. I'd like to know how many women in the room like red roses. And only about 6 raised their hand. They didn't ask if they liked red roses. Personally, I like white. I don't like red. They remind me of mafia funerals and kind of bothers me. So in my case, I like white, and Jeff now sends white after this seminar that he went to. I always get white. Yay, you know. You got to ask. Don't give them what. And this is really hard to teach the offending partner. Because remember, they've been projecting, what we call projecting. Huh? I'm going to try to use it. They've been guessing. They've been mind reading their spouse for many years because they aren't really good at having deep conversations with their spouse. So they don't really know what their spouse wants. Many spouses live in what I would call the Cinderella complex. Anybody read that book in the 70s? Real popular book. Cinderella complex goes like this. If he loved me, he would know what size my shoe was. He would know that it was my shoe. He would know that I like transparent shoes. He would know just how to dance with me the first time. Our dance would be perfect. He would know what to say to me. He would know to whisper in my left ear, not my right. He would just know me, and that is how I will know that I am loved. In fact, that is not how we know that we are loved. We know that we are loved because we practice back and forth. Oh, he likes it when I whisper in his left ear, not in his right ear. Note to self. Paying attention. Sometimes we have to ask, do you like me to whisper in your left ear or your right ear? Well, no, my hearing aid's in my right ear. For God's sakes, don't whisper in the right ear, okay? So we have to ask. It's so critical to ask. And then even more importantly, because you got your stubborn people out there who, even though they ask questions, they still go with what's in their own head. My mother-in-law is that person, and I love her a lot. When she started having to take a blood thinner about 5 years ago, she was told by numerous doctors, more than one doctor, her sons, her daughters, me, everybody, including me, by the way, okay, that you cannot take anything that has Advil in it because it will cause a nosebleed somewhere. It will cause extra bleeding. You can't have anything that has Advil, not Aleve, not Advil, not ibuprofen, none of that. Okay, sure. Well, Marianne, her best friend, told her that Aleve didn't have Advil in it. So she took a leave for like 3 weeks, and one day she calls me, my nose won't stop bleeding. Mom, we said. She said, well, I thought it was okay. She didn't care what the doctor said. She wasn't listening. She didn't really hear the list of 3. She only heard a list of 2. Really critical. Be the person who hears the list of 3. Teach the offending spouse to do that. Now, a lot of this is going to be really hard to do in the setting that you're in. If you're a counselor, you're going to read a whole bunch of books and you'll learn some, I'm sure you've already done it, you've learned some wonderful techniques for handling affairs. If you are a pastor, we encourage you at some juncture to refer these couples to counselors in your area. We'd like it to be us, but we're okay if you refer them to other people. Counseling really works. Couples counseling, we call it family counseling when we bill it to insurance, but couples counseling works. Anybody want to guess why? And counselors, you can answer this. Why does counseling for couples who've experienced infidelity work? How do you mean? All right. And how does that neutrality help the couple? Okay, so it might get them out of their own heads and out of their own realities and perhaps help to see the other person's reality. Okay, that's one important aspect. What else?
We can referee. If there's fights, they don't, you
Who can referee?
The counselor. So, okay, you get picked off normally at home, you would leave, get in your car, and go play golf. But you have to stay in the same room.
Okay, are you a counselor?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, what I recommend, though, is in my counseling is that I try to stay out of the box of judge and jury as a counselor. I really do try to stay away from that trap of referee. Now, certainly, I'm not going to let the two of them come to blows. I agree. When they're in my office, I wouldn't do that. I do try to stay out of the referee box. What I do is try to go back to the coach's box and say, these are techniques you can practice at home. These are some behaviors based on what I've just witnessed in here that you might want to try. If they don't work, come back next week and we'll try something else. I think the way counseling works in two ways. First of all, it's a relationship. Counseling is a relationship between, in the case of couples counseling, between the spouses. Between the spouses and the spouses to get the each individual spouse and the therapist, so kind of a one to one to one, and then the being able to view the relationship of the couple as its own entity in the sessions. Relationships heal. The relationships that we have in our lives are what heal us. The relationship with God is my most healing relationship usually in my life if I let it be. The second most healing relationship I can ever have in my life is a happy marriage. It heals all the wounds of my past every day that it goes well. It might create a few new wounds on the days that it goes bad. It is a paradigm of God's love for us. So in counseling, we get to do a couple of things. We get to practice. We get to practice sometimes being our worst self on those days that it feels like I'm refereeing two people. That's when the members of the... of the couple they're showing us their worst self and they're fighting it out and they're telling each other just what they think and they're doing all their real dysfunctional behaviors that we all have and they're showing it to me. That's a great day in counseling because I get to see what they're doing and I encourage people. I say, go ahead, be your worst self today. Next week you get to have a choice. Do you want to be your best self? Do you want to be your worst self? Or do you want to try something different? So in counseling, we get to try out new behaviors. We get the opportunity to relate to our spouse in front of what he recommended, what this other gentleman said, is an impartial, perhaps somewhat disinterested party. And then most directly, my most important job as a therapist, and certainly the most important job of any helping professional, is that I'm able to offer hope. I recommend that when you leave here today, you start paying attention to all the places and all the things in life that bring you hope. It's a scripture verse. It's a TV show you watched. It's a story you heard. It's something you saw in nature. Whatever it is, bringing hope to a relationship that has no hope. Can you imagine anything more upsetting than enduring the pain of your greatest failure every day for at least 12 hours? And those of us who work full-time outside the home are probably still going, even if we're sleeping for part of it, we'll be in our home 12 hours of every day, probably with our spouse. That's a lot of time for things to suck. So bringing hope where hope doesn't exist is your first job. Your second job, let's just review. Stop the affair. Make sure they quit. Whatever it takes, they have to stop. Third job, and I don't think I highlighted this real well, I'm afraid I skipped it, is to get a contract from the couple that both people are 2 feet in. I have had, I don't know, any of you who are couples counselors can perhaps raise your hand if you've seen this. People come to counseling, they say, oh, yep, I want counseling. But 1 foot is out of the relationship. They're not 2 feet in. Well, I'm just going to see if we can make this work because I don't want to file for divorce if I haven't tried. But in those cases, those people are usually not 2 feet in. So what I say to them, if you have called your attorney, then we probably aren't going to do couples counseling. We're going to do divorce counseling, and that's something very different. So I get a contract right up front. Are we doing couples counseling, or are we doing divorce counseling? And if we need to have a whole process of figuring that out, let's do that now. So make sure both parties are 2 feet in. And then, of course, you need to promise that your 2 feet in will stay with them and you will bring hope and you will bring healing where God allows it. Third one. These two have some deep-seated issues. Refer them to a counselor. Okay. That just makes it super simple. Because this is hard work, and it usually takes a long time. Has anybody have any evidence to the contrary that you can help out couples in a shorter period of time? And I'm really okay if you do, and I won't be offended if you give me an example. But has anyone ever seen it where people healed quickly? Okay, so I want you to all call UPMC and Highmark and let them know that we need more than six sessions for this, okay? We need to get paid. All right. All right, so we have a couple minutes for questions or comments. Really, if you have a comment, something you want to give to other counselors, or go ahead.
Do you often see the other spouse still have an affair that's even out?
I will not say that I've often heard people contemplate it. No. No, because remember, this is not about sex. Now, I do have, that said, I do have an example in my mind of a couple that did that. And honest to God, it did not make the offended party feel any better to have sex with her best friend. Didn't help her at all. And she said so. She was super disappointed. She thought it would help. They're still married, though. What's nice. Go ahead. Anything else?
How long did you think our new friend takes to restore trust?
I don't know. I'm really not going to be flippant when I say this. This might sound flippant, but I do think that has a lot to do with God and the universe. What can this person allow in their heart? And God works in that space. I'm assuming that we're talking to most people who in this room, most of you, believe in a power greater than yourself, whatever you decide to call it. And remember I said relationships heal people. All kinds of relationships. And if our marriage is a paradigm for God's love for his people and love for the church, how long does it take to heal? Well, as much time as God ordains it. I encourage people of faith to think about it that way, because then there's no imperative that I must force this round peg into this square hole. If I allow the round peg, it might go in the square hole with God's in God's time, and I bet it will. And it may, the round peg may turn into a square, and the square hole may turn into a round peg, or a round hole, and we will fit together again. That's my answer. Does anyone else have an answer for that one? How long does it take? I mean, I'm not sure I know it all yet.
A day at a time.
Yeah.
Is generally the time to get trust back.
And how long does that take?
And that can take a long time.
And I think that depends greatly on my... Oh, I'm sorry.
To prove that it isn't going to happen again.
Yeah.
That's the fear. So that involves time, I think, to make sure that there is not going to be a relapse apparent to the offended party.
I'm glad you brought that up. I have a metaphor for you that you might want to take. If you look around the room, there are hooks on the walls. I had a client for a couple of years that I worked with, and her thing was, I'll forgive my husband when I know he won't do it again. And so we used to talk about letting him off the hook. She says, you know, I'll let him off the hook. I'm afraid to let him off the hook, because if I let him off the hook, he'll do it again. Now, this guy had some sexual addiction. Okay, so this is just kind of an extreme example. And I could understand how she wanted to keep him hung up on that hook, so what would happen? Right? Why would she want to keep him hung up on a hook? Literally on a hook. Why would she want that?
She could forgive and trust that, yep, there's the mind does not forget.
So she kept him up on that hook. Right, and she believed that as long as he was up on that hook, he would never transgress against her again. But think about that. That's folly. There's nothing accurate about that. As long as I keep you up on the hook, I can keep you on the hook as long as I want to, figuratively, metaphorically, but you can still do it. If I let you off the hook, if I forgive you, you're still free to transgress against me again. So either way, I spend 5 years in misery, keeping you on the hook, plotting revenge, feeling angry, riddled with resentment. I'm just going to be 5 years older, and so is he. He will have transgressed or not. So my decision is critical. Do I want to spend the next 5 years filled, riddled with resentment, unwilling to forgive, and plotting revenge? When in those 5 years, I'll have more wrinkles than I would have had otherwise. I will be more, gravity will have had a greater effect on me in those 5 years than if in those 5 years I was able to enter into a process through God to forgive. That I can accept God's mercy in a way that I can pass it on. And that's the key. How do I learn to accept God's mercy in such a way that I can give it back to this person who teased me off more than anybody in the world? Okay? Giving God's mercy back is a process to go through. And for those of you who are both pastors and counselors, teachers, whatever you are, that's a critical portion of your work. Teaching people how to take God's mercy first and then give it away. Question?
$600.
And the man is not really vested in the relationship. And he walks off, and your six sessions are over, and he walks off, and he's gone. Now here's mom, and she's left, and she's got the kids, and she's got all this on her plate. Dad's off having his good old time doing what he's doing. And mom, you're working with a whole different entity here, because now you're looking at mom, who she might be planning that revenge, not emotionally with an affair, but the revenge and the anger. Now I'm going to use these kids as a pawn against him. Now I'm going to do this, and now I'm going to do that. And then, we have that job as counselors to really get her to focus on self-care and to take that anger and try to turn that, let that anger go. It's a very, very difficult, hard thing to try to maybe bring her into the church if she, if these people were not faith-based to begin with, and to kind of let that go and to start to take care of you.
Right, and that other-centered notion. So to be other-centered is often not super healthy.
Mm-hmm.
To be God-centered is a whole lot healthier.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's complicated.
And I know closely, and there's nothing happening there. Closely loved her. The lady had 10 children up by her. Closely loved her. And that was her mind at work. And my wife also counseled her, too. But she was just having trouble with that. Because it happened previously in her history that she was just super sensitive.
You can't blame her. Yeah.
Can't blame
it's
her.
The little dog,
and
the dog in the tail. Well, thank you very much. All of you who shared, all of you who just gave us your very careful attention, we really appreciate this. If you have any questions, our number is in there. You can always call us. Referrals we'll take, questions we'll take, advice we'll take that. I'll just close quickly with a prayer. Dear God, we thank you for this time to spend together in a way of finding a way to serve you, to serve the good example that you gave us of the families at work and how Christ loved his church. In the name of your Son, Jesus, amen. Thank you.
If anybody didn't get the handout, see me and we'll get them to you.
And I encourage you in your pre-married work to use some of those quizzes as a jumping off point for your young married. Thank you.